Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Skylines is brought to you by 100 Resilient Cities. Pioneered by the Rockefeller Foundation, 100 Resilient Cities is dedicated to helping cities around the world become more resilient to the physical, social, and economic challenges of the growing part of the 21st century. You can find out more at its website, 100resilientcities.org.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, the City Metro podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Stephanie. Hi.
Oh my God, it's you again. You're back. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you, John. How are you?
I'm all right. How's life on the outside? How is blissful freedom?
Let's hope that none of the people who used to employ us both who used to say that. It's good. I'm good.
So they don't listen. It's fine. They're not going to, you know, safe space.
I'm really well, thank you. I've almost finished the PhD that's going in this week, and yeah.
Oh wow! So how what's the turnaround to these things? Like, how long after that do you still have to do your Viva and all that stuff, or do they just like say, yeah, that's it, you're fine?
No, yeah, as you intimate, there's a big long turnaround. So it's about 3 months sometimes until the Viva, but we'll see. There might be a way to turn around faster, or it might take longer. So. Don't worry, the minute you can call me Dr. Boland, I will be letting you know in the strongest possible terms.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I assume if we manage to do any podcasts after that, that's how you'll be introducing yourself from then on.
That's how I'll be introducing myself in all contexts from then on.
Yeah, you know, you're having dinner with your parents or whatever.
So what are we talking about today?
Okay, we are going to talk about a fairly frequent topic. We're going to talk about deindustrialization or bouncing back from it. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from some guests from the very fine cities of Pittsburgh and Glasgow. Also, as the listeners will have picked up by now, this is very much just a Skype based version of the podcast. So please do bear with us if there's any kind of slight cuts in the connection, but you know, we are doing what we can.
Yeah, I should say I'm currently podcasting from a armchair in my living room, whereas John is actually at work.
Yeah, and you know, if you hear anyone sort of nattering away in the background, that's just, you know, people. It's just, you know, an insight into a Wednesday lunchtime at the New Statesman, which is, you know, all anyone ever wants out of life, I'm sure.
Either that or my house is haunted, so maybe if you hear something in the background, maybe don't tell us.
Yeah, just in case it's scary.
So, John, why do we keep coming back to this topic? Because you are not from a post-industrial city, are you? You're from kind of post-agricultural suburbia, if anything.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I'm from outer London. I'm from the Essex bit of outer London, which, as you say, was largely places that grew up as dormitory suburbs around tube and train lines into London. But I am gonna take some issue with what you just said, because actually something we don't often think about is London is also a post-industrial city. Like, London was also a manufacturing centre, and you know, it grew as a trading post, grew around its docks. And the only reason we kind of think of it in a sort of different category to somewhere like, you know, I don't know, Manchester or Cleveland, Ohio, or whatever it may be, is actually because London's already kind of made that transition to a service economy, and so it's not so much that London isn't post-industrial, it's that when we say post-industrial, we mean that it's kind of failed to move on to the next part of what the modern economy would look like.
Right, okay. So what, I'm guessing, like me though, when you think post-industrial, you do tend to think of those same places. You think of kind of Manchester, Liverpool, you know, Dundee, Glasgow.
Yeah, or the Rust Belt cities in the Midwest, or actually in the US though, there is another, like New England, something I didn't realise till I was there last autumn, but New England is also post-industrial. And Boston was a very industrial city. It's just, again, because like it's you know, prettier and has moved on to a service economy, like we think of it in a different category, but really all major Western cities at some point will have been through that industrial phase, I think.
And it's interesting just thinking, keeping to the UK, just because it's kind of what I know best, but I'd really be interested to hear from our listeners who are from outside the UK and the US what their experiences of this have been. But sticking to the UK for a minute, thinking about Cornwall on the southwest, where you have the city of Truro, where they're really trying to get broadband funding and digital tech stuff off the ground. And we think of that as a tourist destination. It's somewhere you go in the summer to go to the beach. But actually, there's a mining industry that's collapsed there. So in a way, that whole space is caught in that same post-industrial phase in its life.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. It's like, if you know, if you have a developed economy anywhere in the West, it will have been through that phase where most of the value came from making stuff or putting it on boats or whatever it was. But yeah, when we use the phrase, what we really mean is cities that kind of grew between, I don't know, maybe 1820 and 1920, since when they've been in a bit of a decline because globalization kicks in. Suddenly it's cheaper to do that kind of mass manufacturing somewhere where wages are lower. And that is it's not quite universal, but it's fairly widespread in the West, that there are places that had their boom a century or a century and a half ago, and in the last 50, 60, 70 years have been struggling a little bit. And some of those places have bounced back much better than others.
See, I'm interested in what we could do, particularly in the US, but also globally, because I know if you go back and listen to different editions of this podcast, you know, we've spoken a lot about what we could do for the North, whether that's talking about the mayoral system or talking to people like Stuart McConey and Neil Atkinson about, you know, easy things, transport links or putting a bit of funding into different bits of the Northern economy. But when you think of somewhere like the US, and I know you went around the US just before the election, so I'm not going to let you go there ever again, but the cities are so spread out. It's so decentralized. You kind of go, what can you do in those places?
Yeah, no, I think the scale in the US certainly makes it harder to deal with, because, I mean, one of the ideas I keep coming back to with the north of England is it really should be possible to turn the M62 corridor into a sort of English equivalent of Germany's Rhine-Ruhr area, which is not only still a big manufacturing hub, but it's actually still one of the richest parts of Germany. Like, that area has survived very well. And one of the ways I think it's done that is because those cities are all very well connected. So you can have the financial centre in Frankfurt, but it's linked up to tourism in Cologne and manufacturing in places like Düsseldorf and so on. And that's just, for whatever reason, that just has continued to work quite effectively in a way that the north of England just doesn't. And I think, you know, part of the explanation for that is probably that we haven't done what we could to link those cities to jobs in the emerging service industries in places like Manchester. But you can kind of see how you would do that in somewhere like Ohio, which is, you know, the size of England. It's much, much harder to do that because the cities are that bit further spread out. So you have all these places that were effectively supply chain for Detroit. And when the car industry went from Detroit, cities, you know, 100-300 miles away also suffered because of that. And it's not, they're too far for you to just think, well, we'll build a train line and then that will sort it out.
Yeah, exactly. Because when you think of an acceptable time period for car parts to be travelling between cities, that's very different from the acceptable time you will spend commuting every day. But it is interesting that you talk about Germany, because one of the things that I think has helped their city so much is having a lot of decentralized, federalized power and management over there, which is something you get in the US. I mean, maybe those questions of scale slightly scupper it when it comes to regeneration. But maybe that will kind of change things in the UK. Brings us back to the question of the mayors. Is this going to be as effective as it's been in somewhere like Germany, or are we going to get kind of, you know, public figures who are talking about the North but have their hands tied when it comes to actually doing much?
Yeah, I think federalism is certainly useful in terms of sort of regenerating depressed places, purely because it means there will be politicians whose job it is to think about the area of a specific area's economic needs. And we just don't have that in England. Like, all power, to speak of, really flows through Parliament at Westminster. And, you know, all the people making investment decisions and so on are based in London. And therefore, it's much harder to persuade them of the case to build a new railway line across the north, just because they can't see the point in it instinctively in the way they could with, like, well, obviously we need a new tube line because my commute is really crowded in the morning.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting thinking about that globally, even thinking of places like Brazil, where I was reading the other day, they now have, I think it's the seventh largest IT industry. I saw they'd surpassed China in the size of their digital industry, basically. But their market share is still really small, and it's basically because you don't have the Brazilian Silicon Valley. And the idea of how you connect up those spaces and you bring geography and industry into sync in a world which is, you know, untethered from geographical demands is a real challenge.
Yeah. I think the problem is you need access to finance. You need a certain amount of political power so you can make decisions about things like infrastructure and tax policy and so on. And you need a sort of healthy domestic market to kickstart things. And it's quite difficult to kind of bring all those things together sometimes, I think.
I think it's true. And also just where people will be willing to move to, how far away from your family will you be willing to move? So actually you need to sync up a lot of different industries at the same place, especially now we're not kind of starting work in the factory at 17, retiring at 15, getting a clock for the mantelpiece. 50 is optimistic, retiring at 16, getting a clock for the mantelpiece.
Yeah, you say that and my mind just starts working out how I'm 50 in like 13 and a half years, and that's really upsetting. So I'm just going to go into a little reverie about my lost youth. So
are your guests going to come up with some solutions for us then?
Well, I let's not be too optimistic, but it is, you know, there are certainly some cities that have started to bounce back. And like we've talked about this a lot in the past, about how, you know, Manchester in the last 20 years has really become a place with a vibrancy to it. Right. It's now somewhere that you can imagine businesses wanting to be based because, you know, there's a lot of educational institutions, there's good transport infrastructure, and it's just a cool place to be. So it's much easier to attract employees. And that's not true in every post-industrial city, but that is kind of the model that a lot of them are looking at. So let's hear from a couple of those.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
My name's Grant Irvin, and I serve as the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Pittsburgh.
Hello, I'm Duncan Booker, and I too serve as the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Glasgow.
Okay, so the obvious question is, how do you guys know each other?
Glasgow and Pittsburgh have been connected for a number of years now through common colleagues at either side of the Atlantic, and we've used those links and also those friendships fundamentally to consider issues about our two cities and their very similar trajectories in the post-war period as great industrial powers that obviously lost traction, lost a sense of meaning, as well as industry and sometimes population left. So we felt there were huge similarities. And back in the early 2000s, colleagues over in Pittsburgh managed to get some grant funding for us from Glasgow to come over stateside and for them to come here. And both cities became part of the Rockefeller Foundation's Global 100 Resilient Cities Network. So that just added a fillip and a bit more momentum to the desire to work together and added a bit more depth to the sense in which we were very much linked through our post-industrial experience.
Grant, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about Pittsburgh and its economy and really where the city sits.
So Pittsburgh has experienced a great deal of resurgence in the last probably decade plus, but has really been on an accelerator in the last 3 to 4 years, following a long period of economic decline. So like Glasgow, we were the heart of industrial production for the United States, particularly in the areas of steel manufacturing and advanced materials. And in the early 1980s, we had experienced a severe economic collapse and the diaspora of our population to other points in the United States, and went through a period of a decade plus of a lot of questioning and soul searching with regards to what the future of the city would be. Over the course of the last generation, we have lost about half of our population within the city proper. So we're a very dense populated city in terms of both population and geography. And it has been kind of the leadership of both government and universities and third sector, what we call nonprofit organizations, that have really banded together and charted a course for kind of the new economy in Pittsburgh. So today, in places where manufacturing concerns, you know, that employed 20,000 people along a riverfront factory have been replaced with, you know, the new economy of technology, of biotechnology and computer science, automated innovation, as well as robotics have really started to become the leading edge of the Pittsburgh economy, in addition to core sectors like healthcare and higher education.
Duncan, obviously you're in Glasgow. How familiar is this story to you?
It's an incredibly familiar story. It's amazing the number of parallels between our two cities, separated by the Atlantic Ocean, but connected by, I think, a very similar history as great industrial cities with our post-war challenges and in many ways with our resurgence. Very similar to Pittsburgh, Glasgow entered the 20th century as a city of a million people. We launched a quarter of all the world's commercial shipping, and we sent around the world almost a quarter of all the world's locomotives as well, built at that time. So an incredible powerhouse of the industrial age, and with all the meaning that gave to working life, but particularly for communities that relied upon those great factory jobs. And again, like Pittsburgh, we play our part in two world wars, and then we lose across the second half of the 20th century, both population and industry. We halve the population down to 500,000, and we lose many of those jobs, those industrial jobs, never to return. And with that loss, a sense of a meaning as well is also unfortunately torn asunder. But with that having been said, just like Pittsburgh, we've drawn on our assets. We've got world-class educational institutions. We're a great sporting city. And we have great cultural assets, such as museums, galleries, and one of the most vibrant artistic communities anywhere in Europe. And we've used those, really, to try to, I suppose, invent and reimagine our city as a place where we were European City of Culture in 1990. We held the Commonwealth Games in 2014, and we're a city that's diversified its economy. We're one of the biggest producers of microsatellites in Western Europe now. So there is still industry there. We are still drawing on our engineering heritage, on our great universities, but we've also diversified. We're a tourist center. We're a place where people come to enjoy culture and nightlife, very similar to Pittsburgh, and a strong sense between the two cities of having ridden some very severe challenges, but having come through the other side as perhaps stronger, but with still a lot of the legacy of those challenges to face in terms of urban inequalities, poor health, unequally distributed across our cities, and all the challenges that go with that.
So what are the benefits of the kind of bilateral relationship that's developed between your two cities?
You know, one of the things I'd probably start off with is the personal relationships that, you know, that have brought us together and the ability to share that common heritage and history. But, you know, building on top of those relationships and history is, I think, the opportunity that we're starting to see with regards to forging our future. And that is really looking at, you know, the opportunities that we see, not just in kind of technology, education, and medicine, and culture, and the arts, but really finding ways in which cities can formatively create kind of the next generation of economic and social and cultural opportunities. I think one of the unique things that we've seen as part of particularly the industrial cities that have been a part of the 100 Resilient Cities Network is kind of that common language that we share, but also as we start to get more engaged and share more of the work that we are all doing, we're seeing kind of a common future with regards to the direction of our cities.
The challenges of what to do with post-industrial cities that grew up around a particular industry or particular docks or whatever, and those industries just moved on, that's a fairly common problem the Western world over. How much do you think it is possible to recover from that kind of decline? I mean, can any city do the kind of things that Pittsburgh and Glasgow are doing?
I think to an extent. I mean, we're very fortunate. Both cities have this incredible history of the industrial wealth that was acquired during that age being reinvested in cultural assets. So Glasgow's got fantastic museums, for instance, funded by many of the people that made money from, like, the Burrell collection from ships. Similarly, Pittsburgh, with obviously Carnegie and Frick, the great steel producers, have institutions funded by that. So if, as a city, you've got a core of assets like that, of buildings, of architecture, of housing that can be still enjoyed by people in the 21st century, then you've got something to build on. If, on the other hand, you're a city that simply, as in the case of the former Soviet Union, revolved around a single industry and had simply a load of worker housing built to a particular formula with no great assets, then sadly there's very little reason why people should want to move to you or stay with you anymore. Where Glasgow and Pittsburgh, I think, win out is that they have that breadth and diversity of reasons for people to come here and to stay here. Glasgow's population is now rising back above 600,000 again, and we've got a huge student population, just as Pittsburgh does. So you've got a lot of young people who are the future innovators and entrepreneurs of tomorrow, many of whom coming from abroad or from elsewhere, in our case in the UK, who choose to stay here, who choose to contribute to the city, and they do that because there are reasons for them to stay. Now, you don't get that with every city that's destroyed its smokestacks and has a load of horrible contaminated land and rubble lying around. You know, you have it in cities like Glasgow and Pittsburgh that have managed to move beyond that and to draw upon those assets. For us as well, I mean, I need to say this next point somewhat guardedly, but I want to make it. In the post-Brexit era, we increasingly will be dependent as a city upon our peer city networks, because we won't have that access as we once had to the broader European Union. So it becomes even more important, I think, for us in Glasgow that we really foster and cultivate those city networks.
Grant, I actually spent some time in the Midwest in the weeks before last year's election. I mean, I went to Detroit for the first time, and I was really struck by the combination of, you know, Gilded Age grandeur and there just not being anything there in terms of an economy anymore. I'm sort of thinking around the subject slightly here, but I'm curious about your views on whether cities like Pittsburgh and its peers can sort of start to lift some of the smaller towns in the Midwest and kind of reinvigorate that entire region that perhaps is the bit that flipped from Democrats to Trump last year.
Yeah, I think there's clearly a lot of parallels that we share with, you know, with our nearby neighbors. I mean, you use the example of Detroit, but places like Cincinnati, Ohio, and Cleveland, Ohio, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You know, the formula can be very much shared across the geographies in terms of, you know, first, I think, understanding what your assets are, but also that there is a shared sense of some of the common challenges that we as cities face. You know, how do we address the modern economy? How do we deal with challenges like climate change? And also, you know, the market momentum that cities have in terms of always traditionally being kind of the engines of growth and development. But now, because of kind of some of the assets and the livability factors that cities have, becoming a place that people once again want to call home. You know, we've seen that with some of our smaller counterparts in Pennsylvania and surrounding states, where, you know, we're entertaining, you know, civic leadership organizations from Buffalo, New York, and some of the other cities that I mentioned, because of, you know, the formula that we have developed, you know, like our friends in Glasgow, in terms of building on some of those assets that were built during the industrial era, but really finding ways in which to take that forward into the 21st century. And not everybody has been able to do that. You know, cities are always and have always encountered, you know, shocks or dealt with long-term stresses to their systems. I think the thing that is the challenge that we face today is that, you know, those challenges of whether it's inequality or environmental degradation or how do you keep pace with a new economy are all happening in a concurrent fashion right now. And that's one of the things that we're all struggling with.
We've talked a certain amount about similarities between the two cities, but I'm kind of interested if there are any areas where you perhaps found surprising contrasts or things that just don't, where there aren't parallels.
I think for us, of course, one of the big issues between British and American cities is when we were talking about health and health inequalities, there's a fundamental difference in that we have a national health service free at the point of use, and that isn't the case in the United States. And sometimes for us in the UK, it's not always easy to understand the kind of slightly complicated insurance issues that arise for American citizens. And I think it's always worth talking about how it is that governance arrangements are different, because powers in which city mayors and city leaders, be it in Glasgow or Pittsburgh, can exercise, I think it's increasingly becoming part of the urban policy agenda. We in Glasgow want more powers for our city. Some of those powers, quite honestly, used to lie with us, and they were taken away by national government some decades ago, and we would like once again to be able to do certain things around regulating public transport and perhaps managing an energy company, things like this. Those issues are very familiar to Pittsburgh too, I imagine, but our approaches may be different. And obviously for us in Glasgow, it's interesting to get to know the difference between the federal, state, county and city level in the United States. And similarly, I guess for our friends in the States to know the difference between a city like Glasgow and for your listeners, especially a difference, of course, between the Scottish government and the UK government, because increasingly now in Scotland, we have a significant level of policy devolution. And the differences are quite marked either side of the border in terms of different relationships probably between a city and national government. I just add too that we're in constant contact with our friends from other UK cities, particularly the Core Cities Network, which is the largest city economies outside of London, the Liverpool's, Birmingham's, Leeds of this world. And they're both our peers and our competitors, and many of the issues we discuss with them are not dissimilar from what we just talked about with Pittsburgh. But again, you know, the issues of how things alter from one place to another in terms of the power you can exercise to do good things for your people is, I think, quite often at the centre of our discussions.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I mean, that was one of the things that's recently brought us together is the grant that we were able to jointly develop with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And the main thrust of the grant is really how we as kind of partners in the States can take lessons from cities around the world in order to help improve health outcomes. And one of the things that we were exploring as we developed our resilience strategy was, you know, kind of these conversations of health that were led by our health department didn't manifest themselves in the conversations that we were having with our individual residents. So residents weren't making the connection, say, to aging infrastructure to their individual health outcomes. And in the absence of having a nationalized healthcare system, one of the things that we were really interested in kind of learning and sharing with our friends in Glasgow is, you know, from a practitioner level or really at the community level, how can we start to encourage these discussions? But then also, you know, from a city service level, what are some of the decision making, either structures or processes that we can institute to help improve health outcomes?
Can you give me like a couple of sentences on what would you like your cities to look like in half a century time? What would you like to have changed?
I want to see a fairer, more just city. We think that's the basis of a more resilient city. And we want to see a more diverse, healthy population.
Again, I would kind of echo that. I think, you know, what we've really discovered in our process is that resilience is really about how do you build people as part of kind of the city fabric. And the idea that neighbors and people working together can help build a stronger, more adaptive city, regardless of whatever the challenges that we face.
So, John, should we do the tweets?
We love a tweet round here.
I'm feeling really sneaky about these tweets because we've actually been DMing about what our big question would be this week and not telling anyone I'm coming back to do it. That's not actually very sneaky or exciting, is it? I felt very Machiavellian, and actually it's quite boring.
I think there are probably, I mean, there are going to be some people who would be very excited you're back this week, but it's probably, you know, four people we could name between us.
And two of them are us. Okay.
Yeah. I'm sure Angry Sai will be pleased.
I'm sure she will be, yeah. Okay, so we asked you, or John asked you via the City Metric Twitter account, about the industry where you live and what that industry was 50 years ago. So if you live in a town or a city, where has it come from? What was the industry that built that town? And how is it still visible where you are today?
Okay, I like this one from Ollie Balam, who says, in Milton Keynes, the industry was building Milton Keynes, and they're still bloody at it.
I find this interesting. So Owen at Problems Dog said, in Oxford, the industry was universities and car manufacturing, smaller scale, but still going. I did not know there was car manufacturing around Oxfordshire.
Yeah, and in Cowley, yeah, it was a huge industry. This is one of the reasons people give for, you know, Oxford is more of a real city than Cambridge, because there was this sort of manufacturing side rather than just, you know, university ponces.
Oh my God, I can't bring myself to care about that, I'm afraid.
It was very important when I was a student, sort of cataloguing the difference, because this is totally off topic, but listen, it's a city's point. But one of the weird things about those two cities is it's the same place in a slightly different order.
It's true. I have been to both and they are exactly the same. And I find it very funny that anyone thinks they're different at all. Unlike Manchester and Liverpool, which are very, very different. And it's important you know that.
Yeah, completely different. But no, seriously, the first time I went to Oxford when I was like 30 or something, it was just like I was identifying specific street corners that we also have in Cambridge, but they're in a different place. It's very, very strange. Anyway, let's read some more tweets.
I like Stephen Cook, who says that in Reading, the industries were beer, bricks, biscuits and seeds, which is quite cool. Now it's housing, retail, IT, light industrial distribution, things like that. Apparently the biscuit tin was invented in Reading, and there's a very good collection at Reading Museum. Otherwise, you just can't really see it.
So, I mean, if I suppose that could be a reason to go to Reading. I mean, if you ever find yourself in Reading.
I quite like Reading. I will.
I used to, in my misspent youth, I used to go clubbing in Reading on Thursday nights.
Get the first
train back to Waterloo the next morning and wake up stinking and surrounded by commuters. So yeah.
I can't believe you lived in London, but you would go to Reading to go clubbing. Why?
Because my best friend, who was a sort of gateway into that world, had been at university in Reading, so he was just a regular at a night there. And you know what it's like. You get to know people and you start being like, you know, it's a social circle you go see every month. So.
Oh, you're much more sociable than I am. Ross Picton writes in to talk about Manchester, says it is covered in converted mills and warehouses, and the village where I grew up had a pub with a mining themed name. Now, this is true. I think pub names are a really interesting way of figuring out whatever the industry used to be in a city.
I mean, that would suggest that in most British cities, the main industry was Kings or colourful Lions.
Or all bar one.
Yeah, all ball. I mean, actually, to be fair, the main industry in a lot of British cities probably is vertical drinking establishments these days. Okay, Carl Harrison says he grew up in St. Helens, which is a town known for glassmaking, and Pilkington's Glass is still there, producing glass and headquartered there. And I think that's, you know, with apologies to Carl, that's not a particularly interesting tweet, but...
Yeah,
I'm just being rude to the readers now. But the reason I thought it was worth reading up, because... something we don't talk about often is that a lot of manufacturing is still going in this country. The reason it's less important is just that it's automated. It employs far fewer people than it once did.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting now, as with so many of these industries, you know, arguably a class of the books market, definitely kind of newspaper subscriptions. If you want really nice, artisanal, lovely glass, you would still go to St. Helens. Just as if you still want gorgeous pottery, you might go to the area around Stoke or to Cornwall. But your kind of everyday common on garden bowl will be from IKEA. So the identity is still kind of there, but the volume of jobs isn't.
Yeah, and this is, I think this is something that often gets lost in the conversation about globalization and the modern economy. Is like, people do sometimes think, well, if it wasn't for, you know, international trade or immigrants or whatever it is, we could have the old economy back. But you can't, because yeah, it's the thing that has taken your job is not an immigrant, it's a robot, you know.
It's very true, and it is interesting how that identity remains. And there's interesting from Bob Melling, who says that textiles is the industry where he's from, and it's still around, but it's in that very much reduced high-end form. So there's repurposed mills and a very dense mid-rise / rural architecture mix. And I think that's a real thing, that you may still, you know, you would go and buy your very fancy tweed and hide where these things are made. I love going to an old factory, so maybe I'm biased here, but
Bob is a very good person to follow on Northern city politics, by the way, because he's just quite grumpy about Yorkshire's failure to get devolution deals.
Oh, I was just going to follow him, and then you mentioned Yorkshire, and now I'm not sure. Anyway,
yeah,
if you want to follow, he's at Melling Bob. I'm going to give him a follow. There we go. But I'm interested, again, a lot of these answers are from the UK, but I'm really interested in this on a global scale. So if you're listening and you are from outside the UK, or outside places like Detroit, and you can think of ways where this has happened or is happening, or things are being repurposed or revamped where you're from, we would be really interested to get more of those outsider perspectives.
Yeah, so if you're listening, please write in.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.